Welcome to the Legal Navigator podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca from Law Training Center. Today we have a wonderful guest joining us, Sharon Banger. Sharon brings over a decade of experience in medical negligence, where she's represented numerous clients in a diverse range of complex and high-profile medical cases. She currently serves as a medical negligence principal associate solicitor at Shoesmiths. And today we're going to hear more about Sharon's journey into the legal profession, explore alternative pathways for those aspiring to follow in her footsteps, and gain advice on how to kickstart a career in medical law. But before we get started, Sharon, thank you so much for being here with us. How are you today?
I'm really well, thank you. Yeah, I have had a very busy day working on my cases, but no busier than normal.
I can imagine. So could you start off by letting our listeners know a bit about your background and your journey into the legal profession?
Sure. As you quite rightly said, I'm presently a principal associate at Shoesmiths. I work exclusively on medical negligence cases, and my role in our department is mainly caseworking, but I also have responsibility of business development and mainly social media and our website, and ensuring that the content for our website is both relevant and up to date. In terms of my routine, I did a law degree at University of Birmingham many, many, many years ago. I don't think I should say how long ago. And went from that into the LPC. In between that, I actually left the degree without having a training contract. I had looked, got tired of looking, and got quite exacerbated with looking, and decided to stop looking in the final year. And I decided to look for paralegal opportunities as a way of making money for the LPC. I ended up in the firm that I was previously into this job, Thompson Solicitors, and we did a dual role of costs and personal injury, which at the time, I don't think I appreciated how valuable it would be, because it was all quite overwhelming. I'd just come out of university. I wasn't sure what I was doing, if I'm frankly honest. And I was just learning as I went along. But actually, it was the best thing for me. And for those of you who don't know, working in costs is basically costing up a case, preparing a bill, which is to be presented to the other side. So I was doing it mainly in personal injury and employment. And actually now, to this day, that role has really helped me, because I've worked out from that role what makes money and what doesn't in terms of the work that we do and the commerciality of what we do, which, in addition to the content of knowing what negligence is and knowing how to pursue a case, is extremely important. But yeah, and after I'd done the LPC, I'd was offered a training contract at the firm that I was at. It was somewhat of an unusual route, because actually while I was in the background of doing the LPC part-time, I was actually running a caseload. So the point at which I'd reached at the end of the training contract is somewhat different to people who had kind of fresh come out of uni, gone into a training contract, and then gone into the work. It was somewhat different to that. And actually, in hindsight, I really, really appreciate the fact that I got to do the paralegal work, that I got to kind of do the LPC and do a caseload. At the time, I didn't appreciate it, because I didn't have a life for 2 years of doing the LPC part-time. But I do appreciate it now.
So what particularly inspired you to choose a career in law? Like, were there any specific events or experiences in your life that led you to choose a path in the career in the legal sector?
Honestly, when I was doing my A-levels, I didn't choose my A-levels with anything in mind. I was doing my A-levels and I thought, what can I do? And there were two areas that I was looking at. I was doing a psychology A-level as part of the A-levels that I was doing, and I was extremely interested in it. And if you haven't done psychology, read into it. There are so many really interesting experiments and testing. And I think the older stuff is more interesting, because they got away with doing a lot more. So it was somewhat unethical, but also really interesting as to how the results that they came out with. But so I was really interested in that. But then I also knew, and a lot of people had said to me, that I'd be well suited to the law. So that kind of took me down a path of actually contacting my careers advisors on site. We were lucky enough to actually have really good facilities at my sixth form. And I started reading into it, and I thought that they were right, actually. I needed to look into both, but I kept an open mind. And when I looked at universities, I looked at both areas. And the more universities I spoke to, the more it became apparent that actually law probably was the area that I wanted to work in. At that stage, I didn't really have a preference as to what area in law. I started reading more into that when I'd actually started the degree.
Just to touch on what you mentioned earlier about pursuing the LPC to qualify. So it's worth noting that those who are currently undertaking the LPC will have on to 2032 to qualify as solicitors under this route. But it's funny because we're witnessing a growing trend of LPC learners transitioning into the SQE. And this shift is due to various reasons. So you touched on one about the difficulty of finding a training contract, or when it just comes to like flexibility. Again, affordability, you also touched on the financial aspects as well, and just the overall accessibility when it's compared to the LPC. For example, you don't even need a law degree to take this route now. It's open to a wide variety of backgrounds. So what are your thoughts of the SQE route? How do you think this will like impact the medical law sector?
Well, I think we're in a very early stage. I think the intentions are great. I think putting people on an equal footing, giving an option which is a bit more flexible to both students and actually employers as well, to be able to tailor what you need from an employee. As I said, my only thing is that we're quite early in the process, and I think it remains to be seen what the full advantages are going to be. But actually, from what I've read so far and the people that I've spoken to, it does certainly seem to be a really positive thing. Certainly with respect to where I'm working at the moment in Shoesmiths, we're very much moving over to the requirements being SQE, although we are still accepting the LPC students and that route. And there certainly seems to be a trend in other firms to be going towards that route. So I think both in terms of flexibility and affordability, it's great. I think there's a general move towards that direction anyway. So I think it's the way forward.
So if you were to like start your journey again, do you believe that doing like, for example, the SQE with online training would have significantly impacted and made your journey like slightly easier?
I think it would have transformed it. The route that I took now in today's day and age isn't actually overly unusual. At the time it was, because a lot more focus was on the training contract. You've got to get the training contract, got to get those applications in, got to get, it was the be all and end all at the time. And if you didn't have one, it felt like that. Whereas I think it would have provided me as a student at the time with a bit more peace of mind that there is another route in, that it possibly isn't as expensive as the route that I did end up taking. And I think the thing, when I've read into it and I've looked at the as an option that I like the most, is that it kind of mirrors what I did in terms of it incorporates work experience. Because at the end of the day, what I found, take away my education, the education is a must, you can't get away from that, but actually what got me to where I am today is the experience that I built up over time. And I think it's that experience, that element of the system, which I hope really works in the long run.
So just speaking on the experience then, so you started off as a paralegal. How did you find the role in actually like doing the task on a day-to-day basis? And for those who are starting off as paralegals and looking to have like a career like yours transition into a medical law, what practical tips could you give them in doing that?
Well, I mean, for me, the major thing that I would say to anyone going into a paralegal role is to see it as an opportunity. I think traditionally a paralegal can almost seem like a lesser role, something that you do if you don't get a training contract, or something you do to kind of bide your time into getting something else. But actually, for me, it was a real opportunity and a soft way to introduce yourself into the environment of an office of the law, of people who work as solicitors or even different types of legal professionals, of contacts in the industry. So for me, there wasn't a lot of pressure on me at the time other than to get the job done. And it was overwhelming as it was, because it was my first legal job other than work experience that I'd had before. But for anyone going in, I just say, don't waste the opportunity. Get to speak to people, learn as much as you can. You can add value as a paralegal. You don't have to just be there to kind of, you're there primarily to assist the more senior solicitors. You may have, in medical negligence, certainly we do try to have some of our paralegals case working on a lower level. But there are roles that you can undertake which are completely valuable to your departments. For example, I have paralegals who draft basic articles or case studies in our cases, which go on upon our website. We have people arguably, when they're a bit younger, they have a bit more knowledge. They've kind of grown in the area where there's social media, and they know it back to front. And offering that to the department, for an example, is really invaluable. And that can kind of, that doesn't just apply to medical negligence. It applies to different areas of law. And it also can go down to basic things like arranging social gatherings and things like that. Making yourself an instrumental part and valuable asset to the team is really important, because even if you walk away from that job without being fully qualified and having to do that elsewhere, you want to be remembered as an important member of the team. People talk. The legal community, especially if you're in certain localities, I'm in Birmingham, a lot of people know each other, and we're always looking for paralegals and people who would be good members of the team. So just using the opportunity to your advantage is always a good thing, and taking any opportunity you can to add value.
Paralegals are like high in demand, and equally it is a common starting point for many aspiring legal professionals. So given the current competitiveness of securing paralegal positions, would you say there are any other entry-level roles that you would recommend for those looking to kickstart their legal careers?
In terms of medical negligence in itself, being a paralegal is great, but in terms of getting the experience that you need, don't underestimate any other role. So before I became a paralegal, in terms of summer jobs, I would do customer service roles. I know people who've worked in this area of law who've worked in medical admin or reception. And I think sometimes when we're recruiting and we're speaking to people, they forget to mention these things. And actually, making sure that a prospective employer knows that you've had customer service experience, you may have been in a medical environment where you've become used to the terminology, you've had office experience, you know how to use a basic system. They're all really valuable things. Obviously, if you're looking at the paralegal route, if you're looking at recruitment on a professional basis, academics is really important, but it's not the only thing, because you can have all the academics in the world, but if you don't really know, especially in my area of work, if you don't know how to speak to the public in the way that they should be spoken to, and or how to deal with admin properly, it's not enough just to have the academics.
How important would you say work experience is in the medical law sector, and what sort of steps can individuals take to secure the opportunities?
I would say work experience is important. It is possible to gain opportunities. And in fact, we've just had paralegals come in and off the back of academics, and it can work. But actually having work experience in terms of, as I've said, knowing how an office works, if you've got legal experience, all the better. It doesn't even necessarily have to be, if you were looking to go into medical law, it could just be a legal environment that you've worked in, because there's a lot of transferable skills. A lot of the systems that we work on are different versions of what, say, corporate or conveyancing work on, just tweaking them to work for us. And as I said, if you're looking at specifically medical negligence, having worked in a medical background of some sort is really good. And other kind of things that you may not have thought about are charities. So there are lots of medical charities out there. We affiliate ourselves with a lot of medical charities. And if it is that you wanted to do something slightly different before working directly going to work in a law, having a look at medical charities and the services that they provide, a lot of which align with the services that we provide, could be an asset if you had that on your CV and you were looking at applying for a medical negligence job. And I think the same would apply for a place like the Citizens Advice Bureau or that, or a legal clinic. And I know many universities do those types of things for that reason, to give their students experience of giving advice.
So on the other side of things, we do get people who have a ton of work experience. So just recently, we've received so many inquiries from experienced professionals seeking to have a career change into the legal field. I think we had an event the other day when there was somebody with 25 years of HR experience now seeking to transition into law through the SQE route. So what advice do you have for individuals who are contemplating a career change into medical profession or just into law in general?
It's difficult. I mean, if you've got that much experience, I think sometimes the issue can be, it if you've got that much experience and it's in a particular field, you'd be forgiven for thinking that possibly that person has become so used to that particular area that it's difficult to transfer over. But I think it just goes back to what I was saying before. As long as you highlight the elements of your previous role, which you could easily use in this role, I think that's the best thing that you can do. That's the best thing you can do in terms of giving yourself the best chance of gaining a role. The example that you've used in terms of HR, you are working with people every day. You're having to give some element of advice and referring back to regulations. So in essence, you are having to kind of provide advice to people. I think if you're looking at work experience full stop, apart from having the right work experience, it's knowing the value of the experience that you have and being able to highlight that both in your applications and at interview. The reality of the situation is if someone's recruiting, they're only going to have so much time to look at applications. They're only going to have so much time to get the information from you in an interview. It's your job to make sure that they know and have the correct information from all the experience that you do have that's relevant to the role at hand. And for medical negligence, it really would be public facing. Having, if you've got experience of giving advice, make sure you highlight that. If you've got experience of working in an office and working with systems, because we do, although primarily we're public facing, we are working on the computer a lot, make sure you highlight those things as well.
Great. So just to touch on transitioning to medical negligence, I was just wondering, did you face any particular challenges or difficulties? And if so, how did you navigate and overcome them?
I think the initial challenge that anyone will have working in this area is the vast amount of insight that you will have into a client's personal affairs. And that in itself is interesting, but it's also a responsibility, because you have a responsibility to take that information in, because that client is sharing that very personal, really personal information with you. And it's really important you take that in and you take it in properly. And then it's equally important that you, when you're communicating with your client, you're doing it sensitively. Now, that isn't so much of a challenge for me now. Next year it will be almost 20 years that I've been working in the profession.
Amazing.
You get used to it. But yeah. At the start, you're not used to it. You're not used to having that much information about another person. You're not used to how you have to be sensitive with that information. I thankfully didn't slip up, but you can understand how people do, because you're not used to being in that position. So I think the biggest challenge is getting into a place where you take that responsibility seriously, but also become used to speaking to a client in a certain way.
So could you elaborate a bit more on your current role, especially just speak about it in the context of working in the private sector and how it differs from public sector?
I primarily represent claimants. So in that respect, the claims that we make are civil claims. They're made on a private basis. We represent clients on a private basis. The opposing side to this, primarily the NHS is our main defendant, work somewhat more in a public capacity. The difference between the two for me is, obviously, if you're a person, I'm a people person, I like speaking to people, I like dealing with them. Just going to the point that we just made, it doesn't scare me to have to deal with the emotions and the mental health aspect of having to do that, but it's not for everyone. So I think for some people, if they want to work in medical negligence but don't necessarily want to be public facing, representing the NHS and working on the defendant side of things might be better suited to them. Because if you're working for a firm, and the way that it works is that the NHS, they're not the only defendant in medical negligence claims, but they're the main defendant for obvious reasons. They tender out their legal work to, I don't know how many firms, but I think it's normally about 6 to 8 firms who primarily do the majority of their work. They report to the NHS and their legal teams, and the claims are against firms such as claimant ones like Shoesmiths. And so the major difference being is that they don't have to deal directly with the clients. They don't have to deal with the emotional aspect of it. And I think if you want to work in medical negligence, you're interested in the biology aspects of it and the experts and the court and procedure, but don't want to do the public facing aspect of it, then you're okay there. For me, I've never worked for a defendant firm. I never say never, but I think that the issue for me is that my motivation in the work that I do is that with the majority of the cases that I work on a lot of high profile, complex cases. We often have clients who are disabled or have quite serious injury as a result of the negligence. Part of our job, in addition to proving the negligence, is ensuring that they their needs are taken care of. So we have to not just, the figure for the compensation doesn't come out of thin air, it comes out, it's born out, in those cases, it's born out of the needs that the individual has. And it's my job to identify those needs, get the medical experts in place to report on those needs, and then to implement whatever is needed. And by virtue of that process, I feel that I'm kind of helping towards making that person's life better. And that's a motivation in the work that I do, in part of the work that I do, which I wouldn't have if I worked on the defendant side of things, because for obvious reasons that you're working on the opposite side of things and trying to ensure that there's as less money as possible available. And then some occasions to ensure that admissions aren't made for varying reasons. So the key difference in medical negligence is the type of client that you work for. And what you want to do really will come down to you as a person as to what you would prefer and what your motivations are in terms of the work that you do.
You mentioned the complex side of your work. So I can imagine in your line of work, you may encounter cases that are highly sensitive and potentially impact someone's mental health. So how would you advise aspiring legal professionals to effectively navigate through these challenging situations?
Initially, if you're fresh in, you take as many opportunities as you can to hear your senior, the senior solicitors talk to clients. That's the best way to learn and talk to them in varying situations. The key thing is empathy. You really do have to be empathetic. There are going to be situations. I commonly have situations where clients are crying in my office or on the end of the phone. And sometimes actually at the end of the phone is more difficult than in the office, because if someone's in front of you, you feel that you can, to a point with a professional boundary, empathize and console them. Whereas if they're on the end of the phone, you're really limited in what you can do. But in terms of how you can equip yourself, is you've really got to mentally equip yourself for the fact that in this area of law, that can be common, because you have clients who have suffered quite an ordeal by the time they've come to you. They're at the point that they've come to you, they're then going to embark on a case. These cases don't resolve very quickly. We wish that they did, but majority can go on for 18 months, 2 years, some of them beyond that. And so both at the start and also as the case is ongoing, it's inevitable that you will face a client who can be upset, angry, frustrated, and you have to deal with this range of emotions. So I think equipping yourself to deal with someone else's mental health when it's your clients, and you have to be sensitive. You have to realize that you are representing them. They are effectively a customer, a client that are to be respected. It's the biggest thing for you to understand at the start of the job. And the only way I can think you can practically know how to act in certain situations is by seeing someone else and how they deal with it. So I commonly take my paralegals to meetings. I mean, post-COVID now, we're slowly but surely getting back to in-person meetings properly. But equally, they'll attend remote meetings online. They'll see my clients in a varying situation, so that if they're ever in the same situation, they'll know a bit about how, they'll have an insight on how to react.
So you did mention about the high-profile cases as well. And I was just curious if you could share any examples of the most challenging cases that you worked on and the strategies you employed to address them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the highest profile case that I've worked on is that I was part of the initial founding solicitors who initiated the action against the Birmingham-based breast surgeon Ian Paterson. For those of you who don't know, this is a breast surgeon who now has actually been imprisoned because the negligence was so gross that it was deemed to be criminal. That aspect of having criminal law involved in medical negligence cases is actually quite uncommon. It only really happens when something is really, really serious, or if it's affected a number of people, will the police get involved. Otherwise, it stays in the civil arena. But this case, the breast surgeon had, there were two main issues with him. He was performing unregulated surgery, mainly on the NHS, but there were some private healthcare instances, which it was unregulated because he was specifically told by seniors in the trust that he'd worked for not to perform this surgery because it was deemed to be experimental. It was a type of mastectomy where he left part of this tissue in situ as a way of maintaining cleavage for breast cancer sufferers. But actually what he was doing in a majority of the cases was leaving toxic, as in cancerous, breast tissue in place. And the patients didn't know because they thought they'd had a mastectomy. They didn't realize that what they were having was a mastectomy, which was very different to a normal mastectomy. And then the other category of cases that we were running with respect to him were surgery, normally on a private basis, which was completely unnecessary. So he was seeing patients who'd been referred to him commonly by their GP with a lump or some kind of worrying feature, sometimes doing the tests that were expected, sometimes not, and then telling the patient that they potentially had cancer, that they needed to have a lumpectomy, so the removal of the lump or the removal of tissue in a certain area. But what transpired afterwards is actually either he didn't perform the right tests, or the tests that he did perform weren't indicative of cancer at all. That patient didn't need to have a lumpectomy or any surgery whatsoever. And they'd had surgery, and the worry that comes along with that surgery, all for no reason. And some patients, this had happened once, twice. Some of them, we even had multiples of times that this had happened to them with the same breast surgeon. So we started to learn about his activity because we were local in the area. Myself and my managing partner, Kashmir Oppal, had realized that we'd had a number of clients who'd come to us who had had, mainly at that point, it was the unregulated surgery. And the problem with this unregulated surgery was that from our perspective, there were potentially a lot of ladies out there who had thought that they had a mastectomy, were living their lives in that belief, but could potentially have a recurrence of the cancer or even still have the cancer without even knowing it.
Oh, wow.
So when it became apparent that there was an issue, we initially reported it to the General Medical Council. And the General Medical Council actually did eventually take it quite seriously. They spoke to him and the hospitals involved and put out a press release. And that actually coincided with the press release we decided to do ourselves, because we felt that being a local firm of solicitors, we needed to let the local vicinity, mainly Solihull, know that if you'd been treated by this surgeon, you needed to get yourself checked out. Because our press release coincided with the General Medical Council press release, overnight we had to deal with 400 new clients who came through our door who all had the same problem. And so, I mean, that was a really challenging thing for us. It's a high profile thing because it was all in the newspaper, so we had to deal with the press aspect of it. But obviously, first and foremost, we were having to deal and liaise with multiples, hundreds of clients who had all experienced the same thing, who were worried, who wanted to know what had happened, what had been said, what they needed to do. So we had to assemble a team quite quickly to be able to get those clients on board, to give them the advice that they needed and deserved, and to get the redress in terms of legal action eventually that was needed. And those cases are still ongoing in terms of the civil cases have concluded, but now it's transpired that there may have been a number of people who passed away due to his treatment practices. So the latest thing in that set of cases is that there are multiple inquests which are running in Birmingham to do with those patients who passed away, who possibly unnecessarily passed away. So yeah, that's what's going on in the Birmingham Coroner's Court at the moment.
Oh, wow. So in your experience, have you encountered any ethical considerations or unique challenges that are just specific to the field of medical law?
I wouldn't see it as an ethical consideration, but it sometimes is presented as an ethical consideration by the press in terms of the issue of compensation culture as a whole. Mm. It's something that the press kind of run in circles about, because on one day they will be talking and empathizing with a client and someone who's suffered medical negligence, but on 2 days later they may be talking about these nasty solicitors who sue the NHS and how it shouldn't be allowed. Now, I think my answer to the issue, and I suppose in some respects it's an ethical issue, is that the work that we do does go to improve the system. The work that we do is necessary, especially in the complex cases where people have suffered a high level of injury, which requires a high level of care, therapy. Those needs have to be met in some respect. Unfortunately, we have a system at the moment where it doesn't always meet the need, and they don't always get what they need from the NHS. They don't always get what they need from the local provision because of funding restrictions. So it's really important that they have this system to be able to be provided with what they need and at a fast level, because you often have children who've incurred brain damage due to cerebral palsy, for example. You can have some of these children who are in desperate need of therapy, in desperate need of the education at a particular level, and aren't receiving it, and are kind of significantly behind their peers because of it. And it's assistance that solicitors such as us can provide, both with respect to getting admissions on their case, but more importantly, getting the provision that they need into place, that is invaluable. So I think that there is an underlying ethical issue with respect to suing the NHS, but having worked in the field as long as I have, I have no issue with the work that we do, because I've seen the value for myself to individual clients.
I imagine there's a lot of changes going on, just when you just look at the controversy in the news and everything that goes on. But for those learners who are going to take the SQE and they're looking to follow in a similar path as you, are there any specific changes or developments that they should be aware of?
The major changes are the restrictions that are being placed on the field, fixed cost regime. So there's going to be, in April next year, fixed costs are going to be implemented with respect to clinical negligence cases. They've already been implemented in personal injury cases, which don't involve medical treatment. But with respect to medical negligence cases, it's going to become more of a thing. What that will do practically is obviously affects the types of cases that firms can proceed with, because it does affect the profitability of cases. And it's really unfortunate, because actually cases which are low value doesn't mean that they are easy to run. It doesn't mean that they're simple. Some low value cases can be expensive to run because they are so complex, and because we perhaps don't get the admissions that the client deserves at an early stage. And now, after the fixed cost regime comes in, solicitors and people in the field are going to be in the somewhat uncomfortable arena of having to make a decision as to whether to take a case on or not based on the value of the case as opposed to the merit always. So it is an area, certainly if anyone's looking at coming into the field, that they should be aware of. And it can affect people, new people coming into the area, because whereas before, in teams that I've worked with, the lower value cases are really good for the less experienced members of the team to work on and to start working on. And there's going to be less of them around, unfortunately, now. But generally, if you're attending interviews or going to applications, it's really important that you have an awareness of that. And both it ties in with the commerciality of the work, and having that awareness that whilst I and every solicitor would love to be able to offer representation to every single client that we can, there's an element of assessment that takes place when we initially look at a case. We look at both the viability in terms of prospects of success, but we also have to look at, can we actually advise this client to take the route of investigating a claim for compensation? Is it going to be financially worthwhile for them to do that? There's always the assessment process that has to go into accepting and assessing a new client's case.
So again, in light of those SQEs learners who are just a bit concerned because there's not actually a module on the SQE for medical law, how would you advise them to keep up to date with the latest legal developments within medical law?
What I tend to do is I get the updates from Lexis or any other training provider, and reading up on case law is a really good way of doing it. And actually, in medical negligence, we're really lucky in the fact that a lot of the developments end up in the newspapers, that the high profile ones. I mean, for example, recently, maternity regulation is a massive thing nationally. Every second story that you'll see on medical negligence will be about maternity inquiries. The biggest profile, high profile one, is in Nottingham at the moment. And also there's the issues around Lucy Letby and the inquiry that's pending with respect to her treatment practices. So I would go as simple as keep your eye on the news. They're the things that you would at a basic level be expected to know, because it's easy information. If you're reading the newspaper, and you're even if you're on social media, all these types of stories are constantly referred to. On a more formal level, as I said, training in terms of Lexis, even social media, a lot of good law firms, ours included, are constantly putting out articles, are putting out content in terms of podcasts, are putting out case studies of cases that they've worked on. Read and educate yourself as to the types of cases that are common out there, because they're the types of things that you can talk about and appreciate as to what makes a successful medical negligence case and what a patient or a client can get out of one.
So just touching on legal career, family life and studying, as you can imagine, it can be very demanding. So what advice do you have for individuals trying to manage their studies and career while also maintaining a healthy work-life balance?
It's difficult. I'm not going to lie. I mean, my own situation is I've gone from, in the legal field, I went from kind of being young, free and single to being in a relationship to getting married. And I now have two children under the age of 5. So you can imagine that there's a lot of work. It's fun. It's hard. It's everything in between. But I would say that the most important thing is you do need to carve out some time for yourself. The legal career and all that comes with it is it's massively interesting. It can be quite, it's a dynamic field to work in, but you are expected to work hard. I'm not going to lie. You are expected to put the hours in. You're expected to graft, to know your field. And it doesn't matter what area of work you, law that you work in, there will be an element of, there'll be a point where you know nothing and there'll be a point where you're learning in every way possible, learning from peers, reading case law, working on your own cases. There's a lot involved. And the only way you're going to be successful at that and maintain some element of balance is by creating it for yourself. You have to be really conscious about it. And I certainly am. It didn't come naturally at the start. And at the start, I had that mentality. I'm incredibly lucky to be in the situation to get a paralegal role at that point. Even now, it's hard. It's hard to get your foot in the door. And my mentality was like, right, I'm going to come here. I'm going to learn everything I can. I'm going to do every hour I can. But there's a limit to that. And you will get to a point where something will suffer, either socially or mental health or health in general. So I would just say, whatever it means for you, and it's different to every single person, is to carve some time out for yourself, be it to go to the gym, to go to the cinema, to meet up with a friend. Make sure you're doing that regularly, because actually it feeds into your work. Certainly if you're networking, no one wants to speak to someone who's just been sat at their desk all day long and hasn't really got anything to talk about. Equally, if you look tired all the time, or if you are tired all the time, it's not really going to fit in well with doing well at your job, in being able to be productive, being able to be useful. So when you're thinking about it, I think there's a balance to be kept. Know that you have to work hard, but know that you have to carve out the time. And that isn't going to come naturally. If you're a hard worker, you have to make the time. For me, you have to take it to the micro level of when you do that. And that's different for everyone. So for me, for example, my kids get up quite early, but not quite at the crack of dawn. So I get up really early and I make sure that I work out most days. And that is both for health, but also in terms of my own mentality. I know that I've done that for myself before I have to get the kids ready, that before I have to log on if I'm working from home, or if I'm going into the office before I have to travel in. That really helps me. And equally, some people prefer to do it at the end of the day because they like having something for themselves at that point. The main thing I would say is just to carve out some time for yourself, because it can add to your productivity, not take it away.
I agree with everything you said. I mean, that's why we've developed our courses online, just to make it more flexible and accessible so that people can have that sort of healthy online balance with their work and their personal life. But while we're on that topic, I just want to know your thoughts on hybrid model of working. So when it combines both remote and office work, has it impacted your work-life balance or your overall success within your firm?
Yes, massively. I mean, when I first started working, it was 5 days a week in the office every day, non-negotiable. That was it. So I didn't know any better at the start. And I mean, don't get me wrong, there is a value in that as well. You get to know your peers, you get to learn from everyone in an environment that's there for you to learn in, and people are around you. But as time has gone on, certainly COVID had a massive impact. We've learned the benefit, I think, of remote working. Certainly in situations like that, it was crucial that we as a firm were set up for remote working and had employees who were used to doing it. So at the point of COVID, I had already been working from home, because I already had my eldest at that point. I'd already been working from home one day a week. So I was set up at home. I'd had an in on what it was like to work from home, certainly not for the whole week, but I learned the benefits. And it really did help, because it meant that I could drop off and pick up my daughter. It meant that I could actually probably do a bit more work than I would do in the office, although the element of interaction I have in the office isn't to be underestimated, but it did help to have that balance. And then post-COVID, what we've done is we've moved to that very model, hybrid working. So we're quite flexible at Shoesmith. So I actually, on Mondays, I take off to look after the kids. I work Tuesday through to Friday. Two of those days is in the office. Two of those days are at home. So I work remotely. And it worked really well. So the days that I'm at home, I tend to get a bit more work done. I tend to do a lot of my paperwork. I do have meetings, because a lot of our conferences where we liaise with our clients and our experts in one arena is all remote now. There was a day when we'd all be around a table, but now majority of that is remote. And equally, as I said, I do get my time in the office where I get to see my team. The juniors get to learn something from us. I get to know them, and I get to know what they're about and what they might need and what they might not know for me to teach them. So I think the balance that method of working provides is invaluable, and I can't really see things going back. It's certainly in our profession at this point in time.
So based on your experiences so far in your legal profession, so can you share any valuable lessons or advice you've learned along the way that could benefit others considering a legal career?
The major thing is, and it will sound cliche, because everyone tells you to network, and frankly, networking in some situations is massively overwhelming. But what I found is it's not necessarily directly networking, but get to know your peers. Networking doesn't have to be an awkward room where you're expected to go up and say, hi, how are you doing? It's almost like speed dating in a work situation. It can be incredibly awkward, but it doesn't have to be. It can start off at a small level. Get to know the people around you first. Increase your circles in the direction that you want to. So it doesn't necessarily, if someone else is speaking to a certain contact in a certain way, that doesn't have to be the way that you do it. It may be that you want to have a chat on the phone. It may be that you want to set up a coffee meeting. Whatever you do, but do get speaking to people, because both in terms of learning whatever field you're in, it can really help, but it also can help with opportunities later on, because as great as it is, and there are so many things in terms of LinkedIn, in terms of recruitment agencies, there's so much out there. But actually what I find the best form of recruitment is if you know that person, you know how good they are at their job, and you've had the opportunity to get to know them on a personal level as well. So that works both with recruitment to other areas, but it also works for promotion. So if you're making it actively known and you're speaking to the people around you about the work that you're doing, about things that you could be doing to help the department, to further the goals of the department, that can only be a good thing.
So again, reflecting on your career journey so far, is there any specific moment or achievement that's been particularly rewarding or defining for you?
I mean, for me, my rewarding things kind of probably come on like a particular micro level. I mean, I've spoken a lot about the help that we can provide to clients who sometimes they come to us and they're completely at a loss as to what to do. And there was one particular example recently where I had a gentleman who had suffered an avoidable amputation. He was a family man. He had a young family. He worked as a lorry driver, so quite a challenging profession to work in for someone who had newly become an amputee. And when he came to us, he didn't know what to do in terms of the legal claim, but also what to do in terms of the situation, because he really wanted to get back to work, but didn't know how to do that. So from the duration of the claim, and it did take years, we got to the point where we had to fight the legal claim. The issue was a GP who didn't pick up on the signs of vascular compromise, who, if they had picked up on it, there's simple surgery that could have been done to avoid the amputation. Now, the GPs involved weren't prepared to admit liability easily. We had to fight and fight and fight again on his behalf, but we managed to get them to admit in the end. And so that part of it was sorted, but he was still in the position of, what do I do about my work? He really wanted to work. He didn't want to be on benefits. He didn't want to not be working. He wanted to provide for his family. So we ended up putting him in contact with the people who do very high level, good quality prosthetics. who provided him with the prosthesis that he'd be able to wear to actually be able to go back to lorry driving, which he did. And so we had this amazing situation where we and there'd be so many people at his workplace who'd come to speak to him because they couldn't believe that there was a member of staff who would do these long distance lorry drives on these massive vehicles who was an amputee, and that he could do this because of the prosthetic. So I think for me, and that's just one example of where the work that we've done can make a really big difference to the lives of our clients, because he's now working. I think he's going to be making a change into transport planning as opposed to driving all the time. But it's given him a lease of life, which he perhaps wouldn't have had he not pursued the case, because he wouldn't have had the funds, but he also wouldn't have had the knowledge. So the knowledge that we build up as solicitors, both in medical negligence, it kind of takes it away from the law, because you learn about rehabilitation, prosthetics, care, all these different types of therapy, and you're able to depart that knowledge in for the benefit of your clients. So for me, it's situations such as that where I can see a practical difference of the work that I've done that I'm most proud of. And that's what motivates me to carry on working in the field.
Great. So just to wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, or what's next for you? Any upcoming events or initiatives that we should all keep an eye on?
At the moment, I mean, anything that I'm doing is via ShoeSmith. What I would say is to keep an eye on our website. We regularly update it. We actually have a serious injury podcast. So anyone who wants to educate themselves on the area, we do have different areas of law. We talk mainly about the work that we do and the cases that we're working on. We're waiting for a particular high profile judgment on a case which involves psychiatric injury, which a colleague and the head of our department is running. So it's really good. If anyone's interested in this area of law, look out for the pending judgment on the case of Paul. And generally, just keep an eye on our website and our social media. We are always releasing content which is both relevant to medical negligence and the work that we're doing, our specific cases. Yeah, that would be the main thing.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you all for listening to the Legal Navigator podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you have any questions or need further information, please send an email to info@ltckent.co.uk or visit our website at ltckent.co.uk.